Welcome back to this week's episode of Electric Podcast. I'm Fred Lambert, your host, and I'm joined as usual by Seth Weinschaum. How are you doing, Seth?
I'm good, Fred.
Awesome. Plenty of news to talk about this week, especially about the Model 3. We got a few updates, starting with safety. Safety is a big thing for Tesla. It's a big thing in the auto industry in general. I've never had, maybe because I'm young, I'm never had a concern when I'm looking at new cars. I mean, how safe are they? But if you look at actual surveys, it's the number one thing for most buyers, that the first thing that they look at is how safe a vehicle is, which makes sense.
Wait till you have kids.
Yeah, which makes sense, especially for families, if you're parents or anything. But it's not something that really came to my mind until like I started reporting on that stuff. And we already reported on the Model 3, got 5 stars in every category from NHTSA after their crash test. NHTSA is, of course, the main road security authority in the U.S. But what happened this week, earlier this week, or when was it? On Monday, I think, it was released?
Yeah, in a blog post, they announced.
During the weekend, yeah. That's why we didn't talk about it the last podcast. It was right after the our last podcast. What happened this week is that Tesla dug into the probability of injuries number statistic that NHTSA released. So that's a little bit controversial, because Tesla has used those numbers before to claim that the Model S and Model X was the safest vehicle ever tested by NHTSA, and they weren't happy about that. So they did it again, but they didn't. They used different language this time around, which I think they did it right, even though it's still prompt a statement from NHTSA. So what Tesla did is that with all the data that they collected from the probability of injury for each test, they came up to the conclusion that the Model 3 has the lowest probability of injury of any car ever tested by NHTSA, which is a true statement based on the data. Now, what happened? it really shows you all the media really sucks in general. Tesla reported that, then it was taken by a bunch of media, and they said that Tesla says that the Model 3 is the safest car ever tested by NHTSA. That's not what Tesla said exactly. Tesla said that it has the lowest probability of injury of any car ever tested. And it's a bunch of media website outlets then said that that Tesla says that it's the safest car, which prompt NHTSA to release a statement that the data that they supplied beyond the 5-star rating, you cannot claim that you are the safest car. So you can claim that you have the highest rating possible if you have a 5-star in every category, which Tesla already had. But Tesla went a step further with the probability of injury without saying that it's the safest car, just saying that it has the lowest probability of injury. But then a bunch of media then reported, oh, NHTSA comes back at Tesla saying that it's not the safest car they ever tested. They cannot say that. Tesla never said that. I saw a bunch of like CNBC and a few other media. They did the bold thing. They did the Tesla said that, and then NHTSA said that Tesla shouldn't say that, even though it was only themselves that said that. Really surreal, surreal media state that we live in right now. A state of media, I should say. But yeah, with that release, that blog post with the lowest probability of injury thing, Tesla also shared a few information about how they managed to get the lowest probability of injury in terms of safety engineering and stuff. I mean, most of it we already know, because they leverage a lot of what they learned with the Model S and Model X, which are actually second and third based on the same data. Though Elon Musk said that if you account for the weight, Model X and S should be first and second, and Model 3 should be third. But it's not representative in that NHTSA's data, unfortunately. What I find most interesting about this whole thing is that most of the safety features that Tesla lists that made it able to achieve that safety performance are mostly related to the fact that the car is electric, which shows a lot of promises for making all vehicles safer as they become all electric. I'm talking about, of course, the larger crumple zone that you can have in the front of the car, which is because of the lack of a huge engine in front. That large crumple zone is very efficient when you have a frontal impact.
Which is like 90% of, you know, car crashes are frontal impact.
Yeah, that's a big deal. Other things, of course, weight distribution, low center of gravity. Those are all things that are much easier to design in a car if you have a large battery pack, especially if you do with the skateboard design with the large battery pack between two axles, which Tesla made very popular, and now pretty much every automaker that's coming up with a new EV now is using the same design or very similar design. Yeah, and that battery pack itself also is acting as a sort of fortifying the whole structure of the whole chassis of the vehicle, because Tesla says that it made a big difference in the side pole impact. The battery itself, since it's been fortified, it contributes to the structural integrity of the car, which is also something that is unique to electric vehicles.
Yeah, I don't know if it was part of the NHTSA test, but I think when there was that whole fires thing and things were coming up through the bottom of cars, the battery pack made, you know, it was like it was catching on fire, but like it was actually protecting the driver from the parts that were coming up through the bottom of the car. So
yeah, so it's at the same time a safety feature, and it was also a safety concern.
Right.
Well, it was a safety concern, but something like statistically speaking. It became a concern because there were two or three examples that happened in a very short period of time that became worrying. But on the grand scheme of things, it was probably statistically insignificant.
Yeah.
Rollover, of course. Also, it's extremely hard to roll over a car if you have a 1,000-pound battery pack sitting on the floor of the car. And all of Tesla's vehicles have been very good for that. Model 3 is no exception. If you go on the Electrek right now, you can also watch all the crash test videos. If you don't mind seeing some beautiful Model 3s being destroyed.
Yeah, there's something about like watching your exact car get hit by a pole at a certain speed into the driver, you know, cabin area, and the fact that it doesn't penetrate too far. It does make you feel a little bit safer about driving your car around.
Absolutely. I mean, especially like the Model 3 has been in production for a year now, and like you're seeing now the data for safety coming out. So it's not like I've taken a good decision to go with the Model 3, and I think it's reassuring for a lot of people right now.
Yeah.
Moving on to a quick note about version 9. We've talked a lot about version 9 in the past few podcasts, so we won't go into much details. But right after our last podcast, when we were in Paris last week, Tesla said that it was starting the wider release of the new software update.
Did you get it on yours?
I think it's on my Model S right now.
Yeah,
not on my Model 3.
Same.
Which I don't... Oh, you have it on your Model X?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I think I have it on my Model S. It's just I didn't have a Model S all week. I'm on my Model S at my parents' right now. And this week it wasn't at my parents'. Maybe I should talk a little bit about that, because I didn't want to go in details yet, because I really literally just got the bill from all the bill. It was all under warranty, but I mean, what they did to my car exactly.
You mean the wheel thing?
Yeah, the wheel thing. So I had a build problem with my Model S right after I got my Model 3. I lent my Model S to my parents, and they didn't get into an accident with it whatsoever. So just normal driving. And what happened is that my father was driving the car out of the garage one morning. And as he pulled out of the garage is like, it's just a very small step to pull the car out of the garage, like maybe an inch. And as he dropped that, the rear suspension on the passenger side dropped. And the old control arm was detached, and the wheel got into a 45 degree angle.
Oh man, you gotta send pictures of that to that guy in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, it was a perfect case for his name is Keith Wevenef, I think. It was a perfect case for him to freak out. and actually a perfect one, because most of the time he freaks out about this happening after an impact, after
a huge totaling of a car,
which I think is stupid. If it happens without an impact, though, it's not an impact, it's normal driving. I mean, I've done this little step on the garage door a bunch of time, and then it's not any kind of force applied on the wheel. So that was very worrying. And of course, we called Tesla. Tesla comes pick up the car. They were nice enough to leave my parents a loaner. And that was right before I left for Paris, almost like 2 weeks ago, like over a week ago.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't like, I wanted to know what was happening, but like being on traveling and everything, and also like my parents using their car, so I wasn't even sure what happened. They gave the car back yesterday to my parent, my parents, and they sent me the bill of everything they did on the car. Looks like they mainly had to replace like two parts on the rear suspension on the passenger side, the control arm, and another piece of the suspension, which broke apparently. Like, it's a bit worrying, to be honest, because it's a relatively old car. Sure, like it's almost 6 years old now, but it only has like 86,000 kilometers on it. So that's not like, I mean, I don't think that's normal for a suspension to have a defect at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't an early car, so it was like the first one in Canada.
Yeah.
And it's a heavy car. Not that either of those are excuses, but, you know, I don't think everybody should be worried.
Yeah, and they did check everything else, too. Like, I told them, like, it is worrying, so I want a full check on the rest of the suspension. And they said that everything looked okay. I mean, I trust them. They have no reason not to. And I'm not knowledgeable enough in car suspension to know. But we'll see how it holds up now. It's just like, it happened while the car, like, was driving, but it was driving, of course, at very low speed because it was reversing out of a garage. So if it would have happened on the highway or something like that, that would have been another thing altogether. Knock on wood that it doesn't happen again. But yeah, coming back to V9. So I think V9 is on the MLS right now, because I got two updates about software updates being available on the car while it was in service. So I don't know for sure, and I haven't seen the car since, because it went directly back to my parents in Shawinigan.
When you're in service, you tend to get updates a little bit quicker.
Yeah, that's the thing too, right? And my Model 3, sorry, doesn't have anything yet. And if you look, my point was, we're looking at the rollout of the V9. It looks like the rollout is fairly slow. Autopilot, the Model S and X with Autopilot, especially Autopilot 2 and up, seems to be getting a little bit faster. So you have more chances. It's still only North America too, by the way. Model 3's only a very small percentage seems to have it, and it's started to ramp up like in the last day or so. So if you have a Model 3 and don't have V9, don't be upset or anything. You're not the only one. It's not completely unusual for Tesla to take weeks to gradually release an update, but this one seems even slower than usual, I think. And today they started releasing another version of V9 too, so if you get one, you're probably already getting one on the newer version. When did you get yours on your Model X?
Well, we were in France, I think.
Okay, so right after, like, right when they said that it was going the wider release on Friday, on last
right.
Friday?
Okay. Yep.
Production numbers for Tesla. We just released that like an hour or two ago. So last month and the whole last quarter, we were following the production number very closely, of course. And the last 2 weeks, people were asking us about what happened with the start of the new quarter. Is Tesla able to maintain the production rate? Or have they fallen again after the start of production? And the answer is yes and yes. So they managed to maintain the production at a somewhat high pace compared to the average of the last quarter, but not like the large burst of the last week of the last quarter, which was of course a record production of Model 3s at 5,300. For the first not the first 2 weeks, because the numbers were for early this morning, and early this morning our same source, which has proven to be very reliable based on the numbers from the last quarter.
And this is from October 1st, right?
From October 1st.
So we're talking about basically 11 days.
Exactly. A little bit more because it was like early this morning, but whatever.
So
11,500 cars total, Model S and X and 3.
So we're now over 1,000 cars a day.
Yeah, a little bit over 1,000. But they didn't maintain that for a while, too, last quarter. Model 3 exclusively, about 7,400 cars. Which brings me back to the Bloomberg tracker. Man, people always send me tips about the Bloomberg tracker. Stop sending me tips about the Bloomberg tracker and how is it going. It's not reliable. And I got into it with the guy at Bloomberg also running it. It's just not. It's like still today, like it was, there were 1,000.
It's basically like back of napkin. And it's got a lot of like very anecdotal type of information feeds, like VIN numbers, which, you know, Tesla could register a million VINs and have zero cars associated with them if they wanted
and they do things to try to mitigate that, but it just doesn't work. Like they were 2,000 Model 3 short, I think, like today.
It's literally back of napkin, like it's just, you know, guessing.
Yeah, and out of 7,000 cars, that's a lot to be off of. Anyway, where were we at? So 11,500, 7,400. So the bummer is that it's not quite 5,000 a week, but it's fairly close to it, about 4,700, which Tesla had some difficulties maintaining at that point last quarter. So now they're definitely a lot much closer to 5,000, and I think also that they give some time off some people the first week after the big rush of the last quarter.
Yeah, it's steadily progressing upwards, which is kind of what you would expect. And, you know, we'll see them getting close to 6,000, I imagine, in the burst now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, like in last quarter, we also had some guidance from Tesla, so we're trying to see how they could reach that. We don't have that yet this quarter. Tesla has yet to release that. Probably going to do that next month with the Q3 earnings. But we expect Tesla needs, we don't just expect them to do it. I think they need to ramp up production this quarter for the Model 3 because they have the international expansion coming first quarter 2019. And there is the elusive base $35,000 Model 3s that should also come with a production ramp up if they want to be able to match supply with the demand. And What I wrote in that post with the production numbers, I think Tesla should try to hit like 7,000 to 8,000 units by the end of the year. 8,000 would be like very, very good. I'd be surprised if they can do that. I'd like to see them at least do 7,000, which is a huge increase compared to what they're doing now in a fairly short period of time. Like we're talking about less than 3 months at this point.
Yeah. Do you think they have to open up a new line to do that, or just eliminate all the bottlenecks in the current lines?
Well, they did say that they're aiming to do it to increase production now without adding lines, which is, I think, an interesting thing. Basically doing it with a lot less capital expenditure, which is in line with their goal to be profitable by the end of the year. I mean, right now, my understanding is that the biggest bottleneck is battery cell supply. Maybe also battery modules too. So like Gigafactory might be the bottleneck at this point after Tesla ramped things up a lot at Fremont. Panasonic did say that they are deploying new lines by the end of the year and they are ahead of schedule on that. So if that works out, Elon Musk also talked about introducing a new battery module design and that should facilitate production too. So those two things combined could be the what enables the production ramp in Q4, I think, is just like how good of a ramp that it enables, because it could be just 1,000 more units per week, which is a lot, but it's it only brings them to their goal of 6,000, which was supposed to happen at the end of August. And Halloween is coming up, so August is a distant memory at this point. And well, yeah, the other very important implication that the military production ramp has is with the federal tax credit. So Tesla set a new deadline for new orders. The new deadline is Monday, October 15, because Tesla, of course, triggered the phase out of the federal tax credit in the U.S. by delivering its 200,000 electric vehicle in the U.S. first week of July.
And that's guaranteed, right? You can still order afterwards, and theoretically it could get delivered by the end of the year. Actually, probably likely it'll get delivered.
Yeah.
This is just a guarantee.
Yeah, and it's a guaranteed. I mean, the phrasing is all orders placed by October 15th will be delivered by the end of the year and eligible for the full 7,500 federal tax credit. So it looks like it, like it's not, they don't use the word guaranteed, but it's always around that time anyway. Like for a time, maybe like if you order like the, and we're talking about that, that's the thing too, we're talking about custom orders. And in the past few years, Tesla changed a lot of its delivery strategy to go more with inventory vehicles. But the thing with this quarter is that Tesla pushed so hard last quarter that they basically delivered all their inventory vehicle in most markets. So now Tesla is very low not electric vehicle, but inventory vehicles, which means that custom orders become more important again. But it's always around that time that Tesla puts the deadline for end of the year, because even now it's more important than ever, because the federal tax credit is going to be cut in half if you get delivery on January 1st instead of December 31st. But that was always also important in previous years because of just the end of the fiscal year, and you want to apply the tax credit in the fiscal year that you take delivery of the vehicle, or you register the vehicle. I'm not sure what the exact action that triggers it. So it was always an important thing to know. So nothing changed here, except that it's a little bit more important this year because you could lose $3,750, which inherently becomes a diamond lever for Tesla. And Reuters misquoted me on that. Like on their article about it, they said that I was saying that Tesla was doing it to create the demand. I mean, Tesla is not doing it. it just happens because they delivered they triggered the phase out of the federal tax credit. But it result in creating demand for them.
Yeah, I mean, the demand obviously is created by the scarcity of the federal tax credit.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that comes into play now that we reported earlier this week is that the federal tax credit itself is in danger now, because a Republican senator introduced a new bill that would end the tax credit altogether, and also introduce a new road tax on electric vehicles. Because, of course, as you know, road taxes are part of gas taxes. Well, federal highway revenue comes from the gas tax applied to gas, which electric vehicles don't use, so they don't contribute to the federal highway fund. So it's fair to find a way to tax them, but might not be the best timing. And it looks even worse if at the same time you decide to remove the federal tax credit altogether. So it's an extreme approach from our friends at the GOP.
Yeah, so I have a lot of opinions on this. One is, about the gasoline tax paying for highway dollars. People pay electricity tax. So you can reroute some of that extra electricity that goes into EVs to highways. It's very easy to do so. Whatever a house uses, not in EVs, can get taxed and go to, whatever those taxes go to, and then the EV electricity can go to highways. Also, you know, EVs.
But you think there's a way to clearly differentiate the electricity going to EVs and EVs?
I mean, you know, with a Tesla, you know exactly how much electricity is going into your car where. Yeah. Chevy Bolt has similar technology. You know, it wouldn't be hard to build something that anything that goes through the car charger could, you know, the tax on that could go to the mm-hmm. highways versus.
And that'd be more fair than just a straight tax at the purchase of an EV, because you don't know, because what's fun with the tax, the gas tax, is that you know how much gas they're using, so how much road they're using, and how much they're, so that you contribute like a fair amount, which you wouldn't if you pay the taxes as you buy the car, because someone could be driving a lot less. So that's the logic with going with the electricity rate, I suppose.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and so the other thing is, like, you know, for Tesla, if you think about it immediately, well, the $7,500 tax credit going away wouldn't be such a horrible thing, because against other EVs, Tesla would be on a more flat playing field, because, you know, they innovated early, they did all the hard work, they kind of got the word out, and should they get penalized for that, or should, you know, we found out Chevy's actually going to run out next quarter as well.
Current quarter, I think, right? By the end of the year, they said that.
By the end of the year, they were kind of ambiguous about which quarter, but they're going to be in the same boat as Tesla. Chevy is, or GM has done arguably the most work besides, you know, maybe Nissan as well, but, you know, outside of Tesla in getting EVs out there. Mm-hmm. So why should they be penalized, you know, versus the other companies that are just now bringing EVs to the market? You know, we've talked about this before, like the right way to do this would be to penalize carbon and, you know, and put a gas carbon tax out there. So gasoline should cost a couple bucks more per gallon. And I think if you did that, everything else would kind of just fall away. Like all of a sudden EVs would be way cheaper to run, way cheaper to own, way cheaper to, you know, to, there would be more of a market to sell them. The resale values would be higher just across the board. Everybody would want EVs, kind of like Norway. So
yeah, Norway is not a straight carbon tax, but it's the same principle that instead of incentivizing the sales of EVs by making cheaper with rebates like in the US, they're simply representing the cost on the environment of gas-powered vehicles on the purchase price of gas-powered vehicles, which makes
And also sense. Gas is not cheap.
Also, yeah. Too, yeah, yeah. They have high taxes on that too.
So, you know, like pretty much in every other area, like it feels like the U.S. government is doing the exact wrong thing. And clearly, this Republican from Wyoming is getting oil money.
And then that's not a conspiracy too. Like, you can go to Open Secrets, you see his donors. Chevron is on the top of the list, and
right.
Oil and gas. Bunch of electric utilities too, though there are electric utilities that are heavily invested in coal and natural gas.
Which is weird, because you would think coal is, you know, they produce electricity. Electricity mm-hmm. gets used by cars. You would think, like, in a weird way that coal producers would want electric vehicles to catch on, because theoretically there would be more demand for their product. But, you know, they're just, it feels like they're all just in the big fossil fuel, you know, one team. Yeah. So,
and also, like, if you go with the Tesla angle, Tesla is also in the solar business.
Right.
They also sort of adversary against, well, not completely, because they also work with the electric utilities, but especially they works again for sure those that are anti-solar. Which we are. Well, there's fewer of them now, but still, it's still.
Yeah.
It's so weird, especially residential solar. Of course, most electric utilities are embracing solar at the utility level, because most of the time it is cheaper than a new coal plant or natural gas plant,
and more resilient, and, you know, all the obvious, you know, cleaner, more efficient, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a Republican from Wyoming introducing it. I mean, the basically Congress and the president are Republicans, so it is a little scary. We've heard something similar was introduced as part of the bigger Republican tax package, and it got cut out before it made it to the floor. Maybe this won't get cut out since it's a specific smaller bill. And also, you know, we should note that two different Democrats, one from Vermont and I want to say Oregon or Washington, introduced bills to not only keep the federal tax credit indefinitely on EV sales. So there's, you know, it seems like a party line kind of decision, unfortunately, right now. As of today, October 12th, the Republicans control like every house or every part of the U.S. government. So they're more likely to pass something than a Democratic bill.
Yeah, I'm not well-versed in American politics to have a valuable opinion on that. But you guys have midterms coming up next month, correct?
Yep, that's right.
Is there any chance that could become like a voting issue, like people could vote Democrat like to push that bill versus Republican pushing the other bill, and you try to vote out a few Republicans to try to get that I'm not sure how it's called, the other bill, but the other bill is to keep the federal tax credit, remove the 200,000 delivery limit and replace it with a time limit instead.
Yeah,
which is the 10-year time limit, which I think is too long, it's too ambitious, but it might be a starting ground for some negotiations. So what do you think?
I don't feel like most people who vote Republican care about electric vehicles or the environment or anything.
But independent, I mean, like some independent that are on the line.
I mean, maybe a little bit.
Because of it?
I want to say a little bit. I just don't feel like if you're voting Republican, you're voting against every clean air, clean water, clean anything, and green energy, electric cars, like pretty much across the board. Like there's been 100% turnaround in the EPA. Like it's just like
I feel like every Republicans that voted for voted for Pruitt becoming the head of the EPA should get kicked out at the current midterms. I mean, it's the first election since Trump was elected. So
I would like that to happen, but it doesn't seem realistic.
It's unlikely.
I mean, what could happen is the Democrats take over both houses. I think the House of Representatives is more likely because 100% of those guys go for and girls go for re-election. So the House has a bigger chance of switching over. The Senate is actually closer, but only a third of the Senate is up for re-election every year, so moving the Senate oftentimes takes an election or two. That being said, if everything goes Democrat, then we can start theoretically. There might be some impeachment, but all these committees that kind of oversee this stuff will all of a sudden be run by Democrats. All the bills that go to the president to sign are going to be kind of Democrat-led stuff, which, basically means 2-year lame duck period.
Because even, it would be more a status quo thing than improvements, right? Because Trump can still veto everything, correct?
Yeah, he can veto everything, at least, but it won't get worse, I guess.
We would keep the current, going back to the EV incentive, of course, we would keep the current incentive, but not necessarily get what the Democrats have been pushing for, which I think makes a lot of sense, aside for the 10-year thing, which I think is too ambitious, but like maybe a 5-year period, or I keep closing that thing, a 5-year period where everyone can get the tax credit from every automaker, regardless of how many they have delivered already, because you're just penalizing early adopters, early proponent of the technology, like Tesla, like to some degree GM and Nissan.
And you're creating an unfair playing field because, GM, or not GM, but like Mercedes could create an EV and get basically $7,500, taken off the price of it versus Tesla in a year, which won't have any subsidies left.
Yeah, that's the thing too. The two most affected by the current program are two American automakers too. So the American law is disadvantaging basically the two biggest manufacturer of electric vehicles in the U.S.
Right, and it's
create the most jobs in the U.S.
The two biggest U.S. automakers, I believe, too, yeah. Or not Tesla's EVs. Not a big by numbers standard, but big by market cap standard.
Yeah, and also getting big were with U.S. employees. I mean, if Trump's whole thing is about creating jobs in the U.S., Tesla is being a huge creator of jobs in the U.S.
Yeah.
Speaking of that. Look at that segue. Tesla aims to have 20,000 employees at Gigafactory 1 in Nevada. That's double the previous number that we had. So that number sort of evolved in the past few years, in that Tesla was first talking about like 4,000 to 5,000, and that's not just their employees, but employees of all the suppliers at Gigafactory 1, which include Panasonic and a few other suppliers. Then Tesla later on, they sort of updated their plan for the Gigafactory. They said that they could probably get a lot more output out of it with like 105 gigawatt hour battery cells and 150 gigawatt hour of battery packs. When they said that, I think they said that they were aiming for about 10,000 employees at the plant. And now this week, there was sort of a tech summit. Yeah, a tech summit at the Gigafactory with Governor Sandoval and Elon Musk. And during that meeting, they talked about like how they plan to expand at Gigafactory 1. And Elon mentioned up to 20,000 employees at the plant. So a big change. I'm curious to see if that comes with an increase in output, too. I would assume it does. I'm thinking, too, because we've heard a lot about where will the Tesla Semi going to be produced? Where will the Model Y is going to be produced? And things like that. There's a chance that those car programs could end up at least partly at Gigafactory 1. And that could explain that employee work headcount increase. That could be interesting. But what they discussed too is that how can they sustain that headcount at Gigafactory 1, which already has some problem with infrastructure because of apparently they're already at 7,000 employees there, and they're talking about the new housing and new road infrastructure to support that. And Musk said that Tesla could itself invest in housing at the location directly with sort of, you mentioned, high quality mobile homes that they could deploy there, because it's sort of in the middle of nowhere. Well, not, I mean, Reno is fairly close, and they have also another town too on the other side that I think is relatively close. But like every morning, it's 7,000 employees going there. Not the 7,000, they work in shift, but still, it's a lot of employees going through a relatively small highway every day and congregating to the same location. You were there a few weeks back.
Yeah, I brought my drone. It was pretty dusty. It is a small highway, and you know, you would think with a forward-thinking company like Tesla, there would be some sort of busing from Reno, and I think they might have something lined up. But there are quite a few people who just drive from Reno to Sparks or whatever that place is called every day, and it's, you know, it's a two-lane freeway, and I'm sure it gets packed, and it would be nice if there was a lot better forms of transportation.
Yeah, and the prices too are going up, of course,
way up. Everybody's talking about it in Reno.
We had some numbers here. Rent has gone up over 50% in 6 years. Now the average rent is $1,318. So for a place like Reno, is a, how do you call it, the biggest small city town, whatever,
the biggest little
town. So it's not normal for that size of town to get that kind of price, of average price for renting home. Also like almost $400,000 now for the average house, which is also very expensive for the region.
You know, I will say, like, in just like the few years since we went out for the Gigafactory opening thing until we were just there for the Interbike thing this year, a couple a month ago or whatever, there are so many more like nice restaurants, nice bars. Mm-hmm. There's like a whole big swath of the downtown that's kind of upscale, whereas before there was like just a couple of you know, casino type areas that were, I would even consider like mediocre Vegas. So I think overall, and not just Tesla, but I think Apple and Google and Amazon all have facilities out there. I think the tech boom is really
it's helping Reno along. Yeah, you're right. It's not just Tesla. There's a bunch of other companies going in the same industrial park.
But Tesla is by far the biggest, I believe.
Yeah, in terms of employees, for sure. Yeah. Still on the subject of Gigafactory, but this time Gigafactory 3 in China. There was a report this week that Tesla is bidding and is the sole bidder. So it's in the process of buying a piece of land worth $145 million near Shanghai, which is, of course, where they have a deal with the local government to build Gigafactory 3. Few updates on that front. I mean, it was officially announced last quarter, and Elon discussed it on the earnings call, saying that they were aiming to start construction in the near future without a clear timeline. But they said that once they start construction, it'll take about 2 years until they start production at the facility. So a fairly quick turnaround. But at first, the production level should be about 250,000 cars, but they aim to have a full production level capacity of 500,000 cars in another 2 years after the start of production. So if they start tomorrow morning, it's be like 4 to 5 years from now. But that was last quarter, and with the confirmation of the production and delivery number that Tesla released last week, or the week before that, or earlier this month, whatever, they did say that they were accelerating the construction of the facility in China because of the great impact that the new tariffs have on their sales in the region, which of course went up from 15 to 45%, 15 to 40% due to the trade war between the US and China. So that affected Tesla sales a lot in the country, which was a huge market for them. So it's a big loss, and it forcing them to accelerate the establishment of some local manufacturing capacity, which will enable them to go around those FT tariffs. All right, some other news about Tesla. They launched yesterday, last night, a new gloss black wall connector, which is of course the home charging station that they sell. It has been pretty much the same for the last 6 years, this sort of a chrome finish. They did a little hardware update 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's a little smaller now.
A little smaller, a little different design, and also some features to enable like multi-vehicle charging and stuff like that. Doesn't seem to be any update in that from. It's just really an aesthetic update with a gloss finish, black, all black. Also the handle is also black. Looks good. Looks very good. Sorts of reminiscent of the signature black that we saw as part of the referral program, the prize with the etched signature of Elon Musk on it. But that one is more of a matte black. This one is glossy, so a bit different. Same price, $500, same specs and everything, so nothing different on that front. Powerwall also got a quick update today, especially when it comes to pricing. A big price increase, relatively big price increase on the Powerwall. On the device itself and the supporting hardware, it's about $1,200 increase. The Powerwall itself from $5,900 to $6,700, and the supporting hardware went from $700 to $1,100. They also updated the cost of installation, but that's, of course, it depends on a bunch of things. But previously they said $800 to $2,000. Now they said that a typical installation would cost $1,000 to $300. So, and they recommend 2 Powerwall for most houses. So,
yeah, that was kind of weird. Like if almost everybody needs 2 Powerwalls, why not just make the Powerwall twice as big? It doesn't I don't know. It didn't make sense to me. I guess maybe a lot of people need 3 or 5, so having an odd number of power walls makes sense.
And I think the main reason for it is just like demand is outpacing production by so much right now. A bunch of people are complaining that they cannot get one because production is just so limited. That said, Tesla has been talking about the production ramp up at the end of the year, which is about now. So in the next few months, production should increase. Tesla is even saying that if you order now, you could get maybe an installation by the end of the year. So I wouldn't trust that really, just based on the our previous experience with the timelines that Tesla has been given about the Powerwall. It looks like some update at the hardware through itself. I've noticed that this updated the scalable spec from up to 10. It was up to 9. Now it's up to 10 power wallets you can stack, basically.
But why would you get 10 when you could get a power pack?
I think the power pack, you need to also link it to like a commercial inverter thing, and the commercial inverter might on itself like be double the price.
Or maybe you don't have a square space and you need flat things.
Yeah, you can spread them out a little bit. I don't know. That's we've seen a few though that they stacked a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
The one in Hawaii with all the schools in Hawaii, they deployed like 400 power walls at a bunch of schools, and that was like the main question. But I think it's less expensive too, depending on what you want your power output to be. Like a power pack with a commercial inverter, it's going to get higher power output, I think.
Mm-hmm.
This one, even you get 10, you're still limited like to 7 kilowatt peak, 5 kilowatt continuous per power wall. So that might be a factor. That's probably the main factor. The weight was also updated. It looks like it lost 10 pounds or so.
That's interesting. Do you think that's the batteries, or do you think that's the packs or electronics? So
no idea. Tesla didn't want to share any details, but it wouldn't make sense of battery cells update, I think, like from a year ago.
But these aren't going to like the 2170s or anything.
I doubt it. I don't think those are made of cells that Tesla's producing at the Gigafactory. I think Gigafactory right now is just specially for Model 3 production. Tesla also sent us a few updates about what's coming in the next year for Powerwall. So they are looking to include a three-phase solution for home in APAC. APAC, what is APAC again? It's Americas and
Pacific something.
Pacific something. In North America, you can get the backup functionality, but still not for the European market. So they're looking for a solution for that. You're gonna get the version of the Powerwall that will work with European markets. More connectivity and reliability. Didn't go too detail about that, but it looks like it's going to get an hardware update that's going to be more reliable and will offer more connectivity, which it already does offer some pretty good connectivity with the mobile app and system and everything. But the mobile app also will get an update. And Tesla is also redesigning the supporting hardware. So you have a bunch of, like, you have a gateway. You also have a third-party inverter if you have a solar system and everything. It looks like Tesla is going to redesign that to match the cool design of the Powerwall. Moving on. There was a cool report that came out of NRK in Norway that says they made a tally of all the reservation for the new electric vehicles that are coming to the market. And they said that they have 30,000 electric vehicle pre-orders already in the relatively small market that is Norway. Relatively small in terms of total market for vehicles, but of course they have a crazy adoption rate for electric vehicles. So we reported before that the fact that automakers are all opening pre-orders for the new EVs in Norway first, because they know like the market is really accepting on EVs, so they try to capture that market share quickly, even though the vehicles are not coming until months or even years later. And what they did is that they did a tally of all the different vehicles, and Audi came off top, but that's because they made it with in terms of total amount of deposit, and the e-tron, they are asking for a larger deposit for the e-tron. They think that they have they know actually, because Audi told them 6,300 reservations, and the estimated 10,000 reservation for the Model 3, but that's an estimate because Tesla is, of course, not releasing that information.
That seems low to me.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely low. I think it's much higher than that. As I mentioned, there are already almost 30,000 Tesla Model S and X in Norway. Pretty sure the market for the Model 3, even though like Model S and X are fairly cheap compared to their gas-powered cars alternative there, I think Model 3 is a bigger market, has a bigger market in Norway than the Model S and X, which would lead me to believe that more than 10,000 in a reservation are there too.
I think 30,000 would be closer, just because a good measure is how many Model S's and X's are already in existence, mm-hmm. and it's probably like a 1-to-1
ratio.
Yeah.
A few other cool things. Kona Electric, they already started deliveries of the Kona Electric. I think almost 1,000, maybe even, or at least a few hundreds. But there's still 6,000 on reservation in the books. Nero Electric, 5,900. The Leafs also started deliveries, but they say that they estimate that there are still 3,000 reservations in the books. Also 2,000 for the Jaguar I-Pace, which is also starting deliveries, but like very tentatively for now. I think just a few hundreds are around Europe. The Porsche Taycan, which is only coming next year, but that's going to be 2,300. EQC, same thing next year, 2,200. The DS Crossback E-Tense, 1,350, and the BMW iX3 1,000, but that one is only coming in 2021, maybe 2021. Next year. Does it start next year in China and the year after that in Europe, I think? But 1,000 anyway is just because BMW artificially limited the number to 1,000.
You know what's crazy is most of these cars are sight unseen. Like, they're not even on dealer lots. Nobody's test driven most of them. And there's still a 30,000 and probably much more, 50,000 probably is more realistic line weight for electric vehicles. Imagine if like car producers made enough vehicles not only to sell to the people who have already ordered them, but to actually like put them on lots and give people test drives. Can you imagine how many EVs would sell at that point?
It would be 100% of new cars, I think, in Norway.
It's pretty close.
So fast. Because they're already at 45% for all electric vehicles, 60-something percent for if you include plug-in hybrids. So, I mean, just with the Model 3, they're going to blow past 50%, maybe 60%. Add the Audi e-tron would appear to be quite popular, to the I-Pace.
Yeah, and if you're in Norway now and you're thinking about buying a car, it has to be a consideration. Like, okay, I have to sell this car in like 4 years or 5 years. Who the heck?
Gas-powered cars. Good luck.
Yeah, who's going to want a gas-powered car? And this is the future. This is the future that we think like is going to. Maybe California's next, and there's a couple other forward-thinking countries, and then all of a sudden the dominoes start to fall. Yeah. And this is what it's like all over the world.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're in Norway right now and you're considering buying a gas-powered car, I'd like to know your logic behind it. I'd like to know like what's the reason. I can understand like there's not that many options at that very moment. If you need a car right now, it could be harder. But with the Audi e-tron coming, with the Jaguar coming, with the Model 3 coming, especially the Model 3, because when you're gonna hit Norway, it's gonna hit Norway with the base version too. So pretty sure that the base version it's gonna not gonna be 35,000, whatever it's gonna be in kroner. It would probably be like an entry-level cost vehicle when you account for the taxes that they have on gas-powered engine and gas. So it's gonna cover the like low-end version in terms of price. Then in terms of space, you already have the Model X, but you can have the e-tron now. If you want to cross over, you can have the Kona Electric. I mean, my biggest worry about all those cars that I think some of them, even though they have high number of reservation, I think there's going to be limited availability for a long time, much like what happened in Norway with the Chevy Bolt EV, the Impera E there, where they had a ton of reservation but they were never delivered. Especially the Kona Electric and the Nero Electric, we already know that they're going to have very limited production, so that's something to think about on that level.
Yeah, it almost feels like once Tesla starts making $35,000 cars, they're going to have unlimited demand, because everybody who tries one is going to show it to their friends and family, and their friends and family are going to want to get one. Just to, I mean, it's already happening. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we've shown our Model 3 to people, and everybody's like, oh, how long does it take? I want one. And yeah. then it's like, well, you know, it might be 6 months, it might be a year, we don't know.
Or it might be a month, or it might be like, how long was it for a week for Jeff?
Yeah, that's Jeff. Like, Jeff. So we talked about that a little bit. I think he got somebody else's car because he got it. He got
after
it
after the quarter, yeah. though, right? Or before the quarter?
Yeah, he got 19-inch wheels, which he had to pay for extra, but he also mm-hmm. got free autopilot, which
that's seemed, weird.
That's really weird. Yeah. You know, like. I guess it's good for him, good for Tesla. They sorted out a car that it appears had been delivered already to mm-hmm. Cincinnati, and he got his in, I think, 6 days from ordering it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting stuff.
Yep.
We're going to end on the Bollinger B2. So we've been talking about Bollinger for a while now, since they revealed the first vehicle, like a Jeep-like all-electric vehicle truck. Now they leverage the development on that truck to unveil a pickup version called the B2. All the same spec that we liked about the B1. I'm talking about, of course, the 120 kilowatt hour battery pack, the all-wheel drive dual motor system with hydro pneumatic suspension, and very simple design, made for easy maintenance, made for easy manufacturing too, made to be robust and everything.
I don't think Bollinger employs any aerodynamic engineers.
Oh no, for sure. Well, we reported on that a few weeks back. Actually, they did make some design changes to be a little bit more aerodynamic, especially with the headlamps, the headlights.
Okay.
And a few like air intake around those were changed and everything, but
it doesn't appear like
it's
that.
It's not
like
the priority for sure.
I love the look of it. It doesn't bother me at all, the look, but mm-hmm. I know looking at that that's not going to cut through air very well. As it, you know, is a low priority for a pickup truck.
Yeah, especially like a utilitarian pickup truck like this one. It looks cool, man. It looks.
Yeah, this is going to turn heads, like yeah. especially in the pickup truck world. And I love the fact that you can actually put wood or whatever all the way through to the front of the car. That's crazy mm-hmm. to me.
Yeah.
Maybe we should.
That's also another thing that wouldn't help aerodynamic if you open that like that latch door in the front. Like,
yeah, you can just have air go right through the car.
Yeah, so it's a startup. They are trying to bring this to production, but it comes with difficulties, of course. They did give a slight update on that. So they plan to make that pickup truck on the same production line as the B1 sort of SUV truck-like. Now they're finalizing the plan for the B1 by the end of this year, and they now target the production for late 2019. The B1 will follow in 2020.
And they're building this in...
The B2 will follow in 2020.
They're building this in Hobart, New York?
No, so that changed. So the company was founded in New York. They were there for a while, but they are now moved to Michigan.
Oh.
And because they partner with the company in Michigan to handle the production of it.
Yeah, they have car building things there.
Yeah, they do. They sure do. Still excited about it. Very excited about Bollinger. I mean, I want to try that truck. It looks awesome. Of course, the make or break thing is going to be the pricing on it. They haven't announced the pricing yet. I think that's coming, though, by the end of the year. Did they say that? They say the pricing is coming by the end of the year? Announcing on full suit of option and pricing next year, 2019, is coming. So 2019, we're going to really have a better idea of what are their chances in the market, really. Because, yeah. Of course, we have to keep in mind that they're not alone anymore. They're alone with the Jeep-like thing. I don't see that coming anytime soon.
Unless you count the Moke.
Yeah, the Moke. I don't think that's the same market.
No, it's not.
It's not. But I was talking more of the pickup truck, which I think is very important as an electric vehicle. And they're not alone. And, like, we know Tesla is working on one. I think that's going to be later. If Bollinger is on time, that probably Tess is going to be later than them, but I feel like they're probably both going to be late. So, Rivian Automotive, which I'm pretty excited about too, because they focused a lot on production before focusing on any kind of marketing and unveiling their truck. They have a big production plan in, I want to say, Illinois. Might be more. I'm just going to click on it. It's right here. I'm going to know right away. I think they bought the whole Mitsubishi plant. Am I right?
They bought the Mitsubishi.
Well, sorry, that's boring, me looking up things, but... Jeez, I wrote an old article about it and didn't...
Isn't it in the title?
Mitsubishi? Wait, it's a Mitsubishi plant. I wanted to know where it is. I think it's in Illinois. Oh. I must have written it somewhere, but... probably in Illinois. Anyway, they already have figured out the production, and they are looking on an SUV and an electric pickup truck. And I think they're unveiling those in LA at the LA Auto Show this year, which I think is in November. Pretty sure it's in November. So we're going to check that out. And they look like fairly simple design, nothing like no weird mobile or anything like that. So it's it could be interesting if they have like the production capacity to deliver like next year or the year after that very quickly, because they have been working on their production capacity for literally like 3 or 4 years now. Exciting stuff. That's pretty much it for us this week. We're gonna be back same time next week as usual. Thanks a lot for listening. Thanks a lot for watching. Thanks a lot to our Patreon supporter at patreon.com/electric. We started shipping out the first batches of hoodies, and check your inbox for our t-shirt. The t-shirts are going out through Teespring. With we are sending you some full discount of them, which make them free. But all the information on the emails that we sent out. So thanks a lot for listening. Thanks a lot for watching on YouTube. I'm gonna see you same time next week. Bye.